Alright, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. I hope you guys are well. For those of you listening on Barrel House Radio, you'll be enjoying the show with the full clips throughout. Those of you listening on the podcast, you'll be hearing the version with the shorter clips. So if you do want to go and check out the full version, then do head over to patreon.com/OasisPod or the Mixcloud for Barrel House Radio, where you'll be able to hear the longer version. Today we are talking to George Eaton, who works for the New Statesman, and we're going to be focusing on the politics of Oasis. So it's quite an interesting subject, a little bit different and a little bit controversial, so do feel free to get in touch if you have your views. Be interested to hear from you. News-wise, the big thing is Liam Gallagher is, as I record this on Friday evening, playing the Leeds Festival. He's also going to be playing Reading. And we will wait and see. And probably next episode, we'll have a couple of reviews of that and see what people thought of Liam's big live return and any other news as it comes up over the next week or so. Right, but without any further Freddie ado, let's crack on with this interview with myself and George Eaton. All right, so welcome to the Oasis Podcast, George Eaton. How you doing, man?
Thanks, James. I'm good, thanks.
Are you really? Because are you a bit devastated, as a lot of England fans are today?
Yeah, after every football tournament, there's always a slightly flat feel to normal life. But I think this one in particular, because England obviously made the first final for 55 years and brought back actually a lot of happy memories for me of Euro 96 as well, which is the first major tournament I followed, and was obviously the peak of Oasis's career as well. So,
yeah, well, that's been part of the fun, actually, watching, like, there's been so much Euro 96, nostalgia this year. And it's funny, I was down in, me and my wife were in Bristol a few weekends ago, and it was actually the day of one of the England games. And she's like, I don't get it. Why is everyone wearing like the 90s England shirts? And like, she went into Marks and Spencer's and they're selling like Euro 96 memorabilia. She's like, I don't get it. And it's like, that's nostalgia. That's our generation looking back. But it is, I mean, it's just so easy when they can do those highlight packages with, you know, Oasis playing in the background, or with like, you know, this brilliant music in the background, and they can talk about the rise of Blair and they can talk about all of that. And then it's like, you know, in 25 years, they're going to look back at this point and be like, Ed Sheeran, Boris, you know, be like,
that's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously with the Nebworth film and photo book coming out, so that will be sort of another nice excuse for some 96 nostalgia.
Yeah, absolutely. That was just the first sort of little poster for that came out today, I think, 23rd of September in cinemas. So, yeah, should be really good. We might do a meetup for that somewhere around the country. That would be good.
Yeah.
So whereabouts did you grow up then? And so I think you're a bit younger than me. I was going to say 96. You would have been, what, 9, 10, something like that?
Yeah, I was 9 at the time of the Euros. So I grew up in a village in Hertfordshire called Chorleywood, and I live in Bow in East London now. And my route to Oasis, probably quite similar to a lot of people at the time, it was hearing Wonderwall on the radio about 9 or 10. And then got Morning Glory. That's the first album I got. Then went back to Definitely Maybe. And Oasis were the first sort of band I really fell in love with. And I credit them with a lot in terms of it was discovering Oasis that sort of got me into indie and rock and led me to discover so many other bands. Among them, the Manics, who really I sort of credit with my interest in politics through their lyrics, because I was always someone who would devour lyrics. And obviously, as we'll discuss, there's sort of political elements in Oasis's lyrics, but it was more explicitly political bands that then led me to politics and then to journalism. But I've always sort of kept that fondness for Oasis as sort of the first band. I loved. And then the Gallaghers are obviously very much still a presence in the cultural and musical life of this country today. So it feels as if, in some ways, it does feel like an exercise in nostalgia. But what's great is that Liam and Noel are still making music, which feels very relevant to these times as well.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not just like going back to, just that stuff. It is, as I say, not only are they making music, but it's still kind of relevant. It's still, doing well in the charts. They're still appearing on the big mainstream TV shows. They are still, probably more so than even like a lot of the, obviously you've got like McCartney is, still hanging around and things like that. But I don't think there's that many like that are still as relevant and as successful. I mean, U2, from the 80s, but there's not many, they are properly in that. There's only a few that are still hanging around and in that world. One of the interesting things, so now you for the people that don't know, you're what, you work for New Statements, so is it senior online editor?
Senior online editor.
Yeah.
I've been at the New Statesman now 12 years and done several different roles, including political editor. And we're for those who don't know, we're a weekly political magazine out every Thursday, founded in sort of 1913 as a left-wing weekly, and available obviously online 7 days a week.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's one of the things I was going to say is being a like an Oasis fan, an unabashed Oasis fan, I'm always surprised when like when I get followed or I interact with like intelligent people, like or successful people in intellectual professions that are big Oasis fans. I still have this thing of like, if I say I'm an Oasis, I think of myself as a relatively intelligent person, and when I, and when I say, "Oh, I like Oasis," to or "Who's your favorite band?" Oasis, and they'll say, and you get that look from smart people, like, "Really?" And they sort of a lot of people do look down on Oasis, and it's and you assume that someone who's like in a position like yours, they'll be listening to, I don't know, like Peruvian jazz or Radiohead or some like unknown trip hop like underground stuff, but you're still happy to fly the flag of the Gallagher Brothers.
Yeah, and actually, I've written articles on Oasis a few times, and I did a short profile of Liam for the mag around the time that As You Were came out, sort of on his rebirth, basically. Headlined the piece "I Am the Resurrection," and also did a piece, I think, a sort of 4 or 5 years earlier on the lost art of the B-side and how Oasis, almost more than any other band, exemplified that art of producing B-sides as good, if not better, than some of the A-sides.
And so you kind of go into the editor and be like, "I've got a great idea for a story," and they're like, "George, not Oasis again, mate."
Well, I rationed them. So I think the key is you do it at the right moments. And yeah, unfortunately, I've always been pushing at an open door on that front.
Fair enough. And do you get like, "Oh, you like Oasis," from sort of the, the clever people that work for the magazine?
I would say, in my experience, they are one of the bands that perhaps polarizes people more than others. I think, some ways, it's a bit like the conflicting emotions that some have about, say, the England football team, which is that they might support them, but they're wary and perhaps of what they might see as the laddish culture that goes with it. I think there's some of that with Oasis, because there's almost a particular idea that people have of the Gallaghers, and it's obviously inflated by the tabloids, and that's obviously something they've played up to at various points. So I think that means some feel Is there a sort of thuggish element? Actually, I think, and this is for me, if there's a sort of political meaning to Oasis, and obviously everything has some political meaning, it's about inclusivity. That for me was always the message that Liam and Noel sort of sent out to the world, which was that we don't care who you are, sort of where you're from. If you like our music, you're welcome here. And that sense of communal joy, which I think you see looking back at great Oasis gigs, in Main Road perhaps is the one that sticks most in my mind. I watched the There and Then video a huge amount when I was growing up. And that's, I think, because it was at a football ground, it's reminiscent of the atmosphere you've had in England this summer with the Euros, of that sense of people united in moments of sort of ecstatic joy. And I think that is what Oasis captured. It's because it's when you have so many millions of people, whether they were listening to a particular album or through a gig, they're all experiencing the same emotions. And I think this is something that that Noel's touched on recently in relation to Nebworth, that this was the pre sort of smartphone generation as well. So perhaps those moments were easier to have. But I think the experience this summer shows as well that you can still recapture that. And I think I went to Liam's gig in Finsbury Park, and there was definitely still that sense of unity there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, talking about the gigs, I think you said your first Oasis gig was Wembley 2000.
Wembley 2000. So that was my first gig of any band. And it was the second night, the more infamous one, where Liam was three sheets to the wind, as they say, and ranting about his impending divorce to Patsy Kensit and swearing a lot and so on. And I remember thinking at the time, I'd obviously heard live performances of Oasis before, but this was the sort of pre-YouTube age. So I was, part of me thought, is this just what he's like every night? And then obviously, if you look back at the previous night, which is the one that obviously made Familiar to Millions, and which is a great live album, then you can see why Noel felt fairly tormented on the stage that night.
Yeah,
but it was a great experience. I mean, I would have been I think 13 then. So yeah, see Oasis, one of the last gigs at the old Wembley Stadium. I have very fond memories of that. And went on to see them in Finsbury Park, which is the Heathen Chemistry Tour, and then at Milton Keynes Bowl for the Don't Believe the Truth one.
Nice, that's good. I mean, so what we were going to talk about today really was, like you were just saying there, about the overall bigger picture, but the politics of Oasis. And it's an interesting topic, because obviously, you know, politics means more than a tick in a box. You know, it's not just about voting. Politics is, you know, when we use the word politics, it encompasses so much. I mean, I've done an episode before on like Noel and religion, you know, and the way he talked about religion in songs quite regularly. And so, you know, and I mean, that can come under politics or, you know, so there's so many different factors to it. And as I say, it's very difficult with Oasis because, you know, when we say Oasis, I mean, generally we're talking about Liam and Noel, you know, in terms of what they say, because the other guys don't say that much. But I think, I mean, taking it back to the sort of the early days, obviously we're now two, you know, posh Southern lads who are going to talk about like growing up in the 70s and 80s on a Manchester council estate. But, you know, they have talked very much about how that really formed part of their life. And, you know, and Noel has talked about, you know, growing up with Labour being, you know, the Tories being for them and Labour being us, and growing up, and it was very much a Labour household. Now, I don't think it was like Bobby Gillespie going out and leafleting and, you know, and actually having that real socialist workers kind of background, but it was that general Northern Manchester left wing sort of upbringing that, you know, that has definitely had an impact on them in the early days, especially.
Absolutely. And I think Oasis were never an overtly political band to the extent that, say, the Manics or even more so people like sort of Rage Against the Machine were. But you're absolutely right that they were shaped by that upbringing. That's still something they'll invoke now. And there is, I think you'd see them as classically sort of tribal Labour supporters. The kind who would say, I could never vote a conservative because I'd have family members sort of turning in their graves, but also because I think you can see they never forgave what the conservatives did to the North in the 80s. And that sense that the old, what's known as sort of one nation conservatism had given way to something much harder edged, where essentially some communities were seen as economically worthless. And obviously mass unemployment was perhaps the most sort of direct material effect of that economic approach. And, you know, Noel and Liam have both talked about being on the dole, and you know, I'm sure you'll come onto it, but for me, the most politically resonant lyric in Oasis is that line from Cigarettes and Alcohol: is it worth the aggravation to find yourself a job when there's nothing worth working for? And Oasis are an example of one of those bands who experienced the door, and actually in a way provided them, I think, with the impetus to form a band, because there was this sense that there's got to be something better than clocking in at the job centre. Is it my imagination or the final crown? Something worth looking for? I was looking for so much yell, but all I found was cigarettes and alcohol. And there's a story, don't know if it's a slight urban legend, but the story goes that Liam went to a job centre and told the recruiter there that he wanted to be a rock and roll star. And whether it's entirely true or not, it captures, I think, that sense of defiance that they had. I think because there was a sense that the system, the government, had written them off. And they wanted to prove them wrong in every respect.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think definitely maybe, I suppose you've got overtly the lyrics. And as you say, I think Cigarettes and Alcohol is a very much a political song. I mean, it's not saying vote Labour. It's not saying like that, you know, this particular policy is bad or whatever, but it is just that attitude, isn't it? And that, you know, that even the way that Liam delivers it with that sort of Johnny Rotten-esque nature to it, and just the sound of it, and obviously like the overt sort of drug references and things like that. This is politics. This was dangerous music, you know, by dangerous like working class Northerners, and that was, you know, that meant a lot. That did, you know, as a 14-year-old when that came out, that was like, wow, you know, this is scary and this is interesting. I mean, the other ones that jump out on that album that have definitely got a political edge. I mean, Up in the Sky, Noel has said about that: we were on the dole at the time under conservative rule. It's about establishment figures who didn't have a clue about how people were really living in England at that time and what people had done to the country. It's quite an angry song to a happy tune. So, I mean, yeah, Up in the Sky has definitely got that element to it. Bring It On Down: you're the outclass, you're the underclass, but you're the outcast, you're the underclass, but you don't care because you're living fast. So once again, it's that kind of, you know, just fight against the system, generally rebel songs, like not in the, you know, the Irish connotation, but songs of rebellion.
rather than kind of overtly political song. This isn't Billy Bragg, you know, but there's definitely that political, you know, rebellious edge to them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think in that sense, you definitely maybe is the rawest Oasis album. I think both in terms of the sound and also in terms of the politics, because these were the songs that reflected their lives when they were growing up. And then they obviously rapidly moved into different territory because of that meteoric rise. But I think it's interesting that Oasis, more than perhaps a lot of bands, stay true to their roots, both in terms of how they refer back to their upbringing, but also the extent to which they keep playing those songs. And that's partly because of how critically acclaimed Definitely Maybe was. But I think there's also a timelessness to it. And the political themes on that album are ones that I think will still resonate with people growing up today.
Like even like B-sides from the era, like Listen Up, you know, has got that great line, day by day, there's a man in a suit who's going to make you pay.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like that, you go, yeah, it's, you know, there'll always be, you know, for hundreds of years, there's been a man in a suit. You know, that is how Mark, you know, that's Marxist, isn't it? You know,
yeah,
there's a man in a suit who's going to be in charge, you know, and I think often it's a lot of those Oasis songs are, you know, they are about, even Rock and Roll Star, you know, it's about not accepting, you know, what the basic life that's being offered to you and trying to fight against it and do something else. And it can be rock and roll, like they've often said. It was like, well, the options were footballer, drug dealer, or musician. And, you know, and obviously they managed to make it out, but so many others didn't. But yeah, as I say, I think it is political. It's, as I say, it's not the Manics, it's not Billy Bragg, but, you know, as someone who experienced it at 14, you know, it was dangerous,
yeah.
You know, and I remember thinking, this is dangerous music, and it swears, you know, and it's aggressive, and Liam's sneering. So no, it's definitely
yeah,
political in its own way. And obviously the interviews as well at the time, while it wasn't, you know, that, you know, there was snipes at Tory governments, and it was more, you know, like you said earlier, it was about playing up. And I think that this is a theme that will come up again and again, is that, you know, whatever Noel, so I suppose there's two key things here. There's Liam generally doesn't pay a huge amount of interest to it. He makes a few comments here and there, you know, has done over the years. You know, when, like, for instance, on Brexit, he said, no thoughts in it, man. I love Europe. I guess the borders have got to be tightened, but all that stuff about going, this is my country, I don't get that. We all live under one sky. I certainly don't sit there and go, this is my fucking England, stay out. But I think we should definitely keep an eye on who's coming in and out of the country. That just makes common sense, because you don't want a load of loony cunts coming in, but good people should be allowed to move and groove wherever they want. So he's,
oh, that's a great quote. Yeah.
Brilliant, isn't it? He's got this kind of John Lennon inspired hippie idealism,
yeah,
I think, but without, you know, without, obviously, I don't think he's reading, you know, the New Statesman, to, you know, to be honest, or the Spectator, but, you know, he's just got that kind of, yeah, as I say, it's very Lennon, isn't it? He's listened to it,
yeah,
a few times.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that. And it's interesting that the songs Liam's written for Oasis, with some exceptions, often are closest reminiscence of Lennon's solo stuff, and that slight sort of hippie idealistic vibe. But I think that's also fused with a punk ethic as well, which is a sort of disdain for people who impose rules on you, or tell you how to behave a particular way. I think which again is a sort of there's a political spirit to it. I think there's a sense that I think you see it with some of the clashes you've had before between governments and things like rave culture and any kind of attempts to dictate terms to the music industry. I think that's something that Liam expresses a rebellious spirit against.
No, absolutely. And then you've got Noel, who's a very tricky one, because, as I say, I think with Noel it's difficult because you never know when he's got his tongue firmly in his cheek and you never know when he's just trying to get a rise out of people. So, you know, obviously, like, moving on from Definitely Maybe, I think the key event is that, you know, the money starts flying in. And these guys are very happy to flaunt their wealth and they're very happy to, you know, be very pleased and proud of the fact they now have money. And I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I think it's much more of almost a hip hop attitude. You know, if you've got it, show it. Whereas actually, you know, Coldplay and bands like that, it's like when they have success, it's almost like they dress down more, you know, they want to look, you know, they want to sort of cover that up. But I think that Oasis have always been happy to embrace that kind of showy capitalism. They've always been, you know, buy our records, you know, buy a T-shirt. You know, they've always been very sort of money driven and been, you know, this is the single, go out and buy it. You know, that's always been part of it. They've never sort of, it's never been the egalitarian Radiohead give your album away for free thing. These guys are after your money and are very happy to then take your money.
Completely. And I think that the hip hop comparison is a very good one. I hadn't thought of that before. And then obviously the other, perhaps more obvious comparison would be with some working class footballers as well, you know, who haven't made any bones about buying fast cars and enjoying a nice lifestyle, because they feel, you know, justifiably that they've earned it, that they've come from tough circumstances and they know they'll have friends, you know, relatives who didn't make it, and they'll think through talent or luck, or mixture of both, I made it out, and that's something to celebrate. And I think that's where Noel has always struck me as someone who has remained solidly Labour, perhaps with the sort of exception of the Jeremy Corbyn period, but that actually puts him in a similar camp to a fair amount of Labour MPs. But as someone who has, I think, what you'd see as sort of social democratic values, which is that, yes, I'm successful. Yes, I think I've earned it, but I'm happy to pay my taxes. And actually happy if the government wants to put up taxes to fund the NHS more, to build better homes for people, to fund education, then I'm cool with that. You know, and that puts him in obviously a very different category to the likes of Phil Collins and those musicians you'd get who, whenever there's the prospect of a Labour government coming to power, they're asked, "Oh, will you be moving to France, or will you be moving to a tax haven if the Labour government put up, you know, income tax by 5p or 10p or something?"
Yeah, no, absolutely, and it's interesting. I mean, you know, so following this, they get the money. They move to London. You know, they become part of the London scene. The Manchester thing is sort of, you know, quite far behind them. And then I suppose the big event politically is the fact they go to meet Tony Blair, or Noel goes to meet Tony Blair along with Meg and Alan McGee. I mean, he said on that, you know, "I went to meet the Labour Prime Minister. Our parents always drummed into us that the Labour Party was for the people and the Tory Party was not. I went to meet the Labour Prime Minister." You know, and I think that was, you know, that was exciting for him, and he was proud to do it.
And I remember that summer, you know, I remember Euro 96, and I remember Blair getting elected. Mm. The whole kind of Cool Britannia moment. It was a really exciting time to live through.
All right, Kev. It's
coming home, it's coming. Well, it's great to be English, isn't it? I think for a long while, we've not been feeling too good about ourselves in this country, and it's wonderful to see people being thrilled.
Do you feel like you're making history?
We are making history. Oh, definitely, yeah.
There was just something about that generation and that whole thing, and the New Labour thing and all that. It was just a moment in time. I kind of felt it then. I feel it more now, looking back. You know, the world was fucking amazing for a few years.
That trip to Downing Street, why wouldn't you go?
You know, I'm too nosy to turn that invitation down.
Of course.
So we went there.
Yeah.
And I remember kind of wandering around number 10 and number 11.
Uh-huh.
And just wandering around, you know.
Taking it all in.
A little bit pissed. And Piers Morgan had wrote a book where he said that I was walking around with a magic marker trying to find Margaret Thatcher's portrait to draw a tash on her. Which is a great story, and I sincerely fucking hope it's true. But I knew we were going to get slagged off for it, and McGee was like, no, I don't think
even
we will.
Even at the time.
Yeah, I remember us being stood on the doorsteps at the end when we were coming out and saying to McGee, we're going to get slated for this. And he's like, no, I don't think we will. And I was like, I can feel it.
Obviously, the Brit Awards, he'd said, you know, there's seven people in this room, power to the people, you know, go and shake Tony Blair's hands, man, you know. And he was happy to jump on that new Labour bandwagon. I mean, that is now become one of the key moments of the 1990s. But I mean, what do you think, looking back with 2021 eyes on that moment?
Yeah, I think it was a fascinating pop cultural crossover. And I think it was also a natural human curiosity on Noel's part. That if you're a rock star and you grew up in Burnage, you're far away from Westminster, why wouldn't you want to see the inside of Downing Street? If you have the chance. And I think the passion that he expressed for Labour, and as you say, very directly in that Brit Awards speech, there wasn't a genuine excitement in the country at the time, at the end of 18 years of Conservative rule. And I think Blair's legacy is now almost inseparable, obviously, from the Iraq War. But many on the left look back at that first term as his best in office in terms of policies like the minimum wage, things Labour governments had promised to do for decades but hadn't done. You know, devolution to Scotland and Wales, more funding for the NHS and education. And so I think it's unsurprising that all of that resonated with someone like Noel Gallagher, and that visit also produced, I think, one of my favorite exchanges that anyone's had with Blair, which was that Noel asked him, so how do you stay up on election nights, you know, 4 or 5 a.m. and Blair replied, probably not by the same means that you did. Yeah. Which I think was just an expression of a degree of social liberalism that Blair had, that at least was very distinct from traditional conservative or even traditional Labour politicians. And I think there, you know, Blair, who played in a Rolling Stone style band called Ugly Rumours, and had the shoulder length hair, I think, as well as Noel being excited about meeting a Labour Prime Minister, you imagine that Blair was probably quite excited about meeting Britain's and arguably at the time one of the world's biggest rock stars.
No, and it was also, they knew that by co-opting that, they would then ensure they had the kids on side. And, you know, I love, whenever I've spoke to McGee about this, both interviews and just off mic, he always goes back to the point. It's like, well, you know, and he says, well, look, me going there, he then helped to get that, you know, so musicians, yeah. Unemployed musicians had a grant for a few years. And McGee got that, you know, from the, he was instrumental in getting that arranged. And, you know, which was, so fair play. You know, you can always, we can have a go at him and we can sneer at him. But I think it is difficult because, you know, if people didn't live through that the first years of the Blair government, the pre-Iraq, you know, a huge load of us, maybe naively, thought he was brilliant, you know, and did agree with so many of the things he did. And so much so, I mean, I always found it weird whenever anyone of my generation says that they support conservatives, I'm like, really? That's the baddies. You know, like how could you? It just doesn't fathom in my head how you could, what? You know, it's like, but if you grew up under Thatcher and then Major, they were the baddies and Tony Blair was the hero. You know, it was just, that was obvious. And no one supported the conservatives of my generation because it, you know, it just would have been the wrong thing to do. But I think it's you know, it's then difficult to then sort of assess that, you know, with Labour then having had so many years in power and then the Conservatives coming in. And I think so much of it is about, you know, the identities. And like you said about Noel, he's had a go at Corbyn over the years. And I think it is often, you know, it's if he likes the personality. And he had some nice comments about Barack Obama, you know, from watching the Democratic rally and thinking, like, I wish he was one of ours. So I think it's not, I think if Noel sees a good politician, like who impresses him, I don't think he'd be too bothered whether they were, you know, I think it, like a lot of people do get drawn into that, you know, individual, you know, being, I like that person, you know, versus yeah. everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Noel probably likes Labour leaders who win. I mean, he's someone who has always prized success, you know, wants to be top of the charts. Wants to sell the most albums possible, do the biggest gigs. And so I think with Corbyn, I think Corbyn represented a more sort of radical strand of socialism, which Noel didn't identify with. I think when he was young, I think it was more, he had that sort of class hatred of the conservatives. But you didn't sense that he was tempted by sort of radical Marxism, say. And I think that's why there's that sort of cultural distance between the political values that someone like Noel Gallagher represents and the more radical end of the left, which Corbyn would identify with.
It seems that Tony Blair's bash is one party Noel Gallagher would rather not go to. Speaking outside his home in Belsize Park, Gallagher didn't appear exactly overwhelmed.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wasn't going to go at first because like, you're going to get slagged off for going one way or the other, or slagged off for not going. But I phoned my mum yesterday. My mum said that I better go because it's a great honour for the someone from Burnage, I suppose. She said she never thought one of her sons would be going to see the Prime Minister. But I'm just going to go and see what plans they've got for the music business, see if we can get some more kids into music, I suppose.
And what would wife Meg be wearing for number 10?
Something bizarre, I suppose.
His record company boss has already caused controversy over comments that politicians are hypocritical over drug taking. Downing Street's already hosted one party. Last night, Chancellor Gordon Brown's guest came from the theatre, show business and sport. It's the Prime Minister's turn tonight. He'll be hoping that they at least will be glad to be there. The postman had a special delivery for the Gallaghers this morning. Whether Noel will be taking one along for Tony, though, isn't yet known. John Dowden, Channel 1, Belsize Park.
No, absolutely. So I think we get so obviously that happens, then Blair gets in, etc. And I think they sort of realised, okay, we're being, you know, used here. I think that's sort of, you know, I think they were all quite, they understood that they were being used, but they understood that, you know, they were using them as well. And I think they all kind of accepted that that was happening, but then he kind of steps away from it. And it's, but then we go into sort of the post Be Here Now years where, you know, Oasis basically became just a typical band, you know, tour, record, break, you know, break, tour, yeah. record, break. And that was basically it for, you know, up until the breakup of the band. So there's still some interesting political lyrics, I think, throughout that time, though. Like, you know, Go Let It Out being, you know, the first number one single and a big comeback there. You know, is it any wonder why princes and kings are clowns that caper in their sawdust rings? Ordinary people that are like you and me were the keepers of their destiny. You know, that's very political. And I remember at the time it got to number one, and Masses Against the Classes by Mannix got to number one as well around the same time. And I thought, wow, that's a not bad couple of number ones. Maybe this new millennium is going to be fantastic. Didn't quite turn out that way.
You're absolutely right to single that line out, and I think it's a great track. And that's an example, I think, of that sense I was trying to describe earlier of the sort of communal joy of Oasis. This sense that the solutions, hope lies with the people, that you don't need to look to the establishments or the elites for solutions. We can do it for ourselves. And I think a song like Live Forever has a similar sentiment in some ways. There's that belief that you and others can achieve a kind of immortality, in terms of which Oasis have done, really. I mean, those songs, and Noel seems, sunned by this himself, how much those songs from the 90s still resonate with people. And I think you saw an example of that after the Manchester bombing in 2017, when the crowd there began spontaneously singing Don't Look Back in Anger. Mm. And that was a political moment, because I think that's not a obviously political song, but you can see why people invoke that sentiment at political moments, because it's a sense of let's believe in the sort of better angels of our nature, and let's sort of stand up for the best of humanity.
At 11 this morning, a minute's silence was observed across the UK to remember the 22 people killed in the Manchester Concert Hall terror attack.
I was watching that live.
You're joking.
I was watching that. I happened to be watching it at home. And I was, speechless, you know what I mean? I was kind of... Yeah, it's a tragic... I mean, it's such a tragic event. It really brought it home to me that in times like that, community leaders and politicians and fucking this, that, and the religious leaders... We're all trying to bring people together and coming out with the same old bullshit. You know, we will stand forever and on. And it took a song to bring people together. Mm-hmm.
I know what you mean. And I think it's it was interesting going back to the Euros, you know, obviously like Sweet Caroline became the big song along with Three Lions this year, whereas that could have easily been, you know, Don't Look Back in Anger.
Yeah.
You know, if that had been Don't Look Back in Anger, you would have had that, you know, communal crowd singing exactly the same as you had for Sweet Caroline. We've had it before, obviously. And then also the montage, you know, the famous 2002 montage that you'd Stop Crying Your Heart Out, which was extremely powerful. And I think people, yeah. a lot of people, myself included, still kind of can't think of Stop Crying Your Heart Out without kind of combining it with, you know, with that football thing. And I was wondering, like, you know, we were all sort of thinking, oh, will there be an Oasis song used on the inevitable England tragedy montage? Or maybe I was thinking maybe it'd be Once, or, you know, if England do well, then maybe they'll use Flying on the Ground, you know. But no, it didn't happen in the end. I think they went for like Songbird, but not Oasis ones, Eva Cassidy's one. And I thought, Eva Cassidy Songbird, come on, like, this could have used yeah. Oasis or Liam or Noel songs instead of that. But
yeah,
they do have that resonance, don't they? That as I say, even if they're not overtly political, there is something political about that act just in itself of singing and coming together.
Yeah, very much so.
I think we've got, there's a few others or that jump out. So for instance, like Mucky Fingers, from Don't Believe the Truth. Okay, I know you think you deserve an explanation of the meanings of life, but what you think that you heard slipped away from your back of your mind. You get your mucky fingers burnt. So I've always thought about that as like MPs, like dodgy MPs with their, I don't know when the expenses scandal was. I think it's probably a few years before that. But yeah, there was plenty of like cash for questions and things like that had gone on in the years before it. You get your truth from the lies you were learned, when all your plastic believers will leave us and they won't return. And when you look in the mirror and you're tying up your buttons and bows, and as you face your disease, you can squeeze into the emperor's clothes. You found your God in a paper bag. You get your history from the Union Jack, and your brothers and sisters have gone and they won't come back. This feels like you could imagine that being a Dylan. You found your God in the paper bag, you know.
Yeah.
you know, that could be. I think that could be Dylan-esque in some of those.
Yeah, things. And there's a slightly sort of Dylan-esque stream of consciousness almost.
Hmm.
And actually, the Union Jack line there reminds me of one of the most overtly political statements, I think, which was, of course, Noel's Union Jack guitar. At Main Road, which has become almost one of the defining icons, symbols of the 90s and Britpop. And even the name, you know, Britpop is political in itself. But I think what's interesting about that, and this relates to the discussion a lot of people are having about Englishness and the St. George's Cross, is that for a long time in music, the Union Jack had been seen as a dubious symbol. So there'd been that NME front page when Morrissey had done a gig with a Union Jack flag, and I think the headline was something like flying the flag or flirting with disaster, and because of some of Morrissey's ambiguous lyrics around race, you know, that was seen as a divisive moment within the indie community. But I think by the 90s, by 96, Noel was able to play that Union Jack guitar, and that flag had become a symbol of inclusivity and of something hopeful. And I think you've seen something similar happen with the St. George's Cross, because it used to be the Union Jack very associated with the National Front in the 70s. Then it became the St. George's Cross after Britpop, because there was a sense that the Union Jack didn't quite had lost some of its some of those nationalistic connotations. But I think both flags have very much been detoxified. I think Oasis were a key part of that in the 90s.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? That it was literally from, what was it? I think the Morrissey thing was 1990. And he was hauled over the coals for it. And yet 6 years later, or 5 years later, like Noel's there doing exactly the same thing, like with this guitar, but by that point it's okay. And Liam and Patsy in bed with the Union Jack, they were always okay with that. And I mean, even like, you know, the interview I did with Debbie Turner from Sister Lovers, and she talks about there being the Union Jack flag painted in the boardwalk. And it's something I've always thought was weird because of the fact that they've got this proud Irish heritage. Mm. And yet they've always flirted with the Union flag. And it's like, well, is it more of a pop art thing, you know, rather than a proud British thing? But I think it's a bit of both. I think they've got, you know, they are proud of a lot of British things, whether it be David Bowie and the Beatles and, you know, things like that. Yeah. But then, you know, I think it is also the pop art factor of, you know, of the fact that like Pete Townsend and Keith Moon using it.
You can see aesthetically why something like the Union Jack looks gooder on a guitar in some ways that other flags wouldn't. And then I think it was also tied to the Yanks Go Home sentiments, which I think was a Melody Maker or NME front page, the early sort of wave of Britpop, which I think was something that Oasis reflected as well. A song like Live Forever was partly written as a rebuke to what was seen as the self-depity, self-destructionist of grunge music. So I think there was an element of sort of musical patriotism there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There is a quote, I was trying to find it earlier and I can't find it, but I remember Noel being asked about, you know, politics and him saying something like, well, you know, we don't write protest songs because there's nothing to protest about. Like if there was a reason to have a revolution, we'd be at the front of the queue with our guitars or something like that, which, you know, I thought was quite interesting. It's like, well, you know, there's it's not worth having a revolution, but we would be there. He was talking about the British riots, the 2011 riots, in his blog. He said, all over the world, Syria and Egypt, people were rioting for freedom. And these kids in England are rioting for tracksuits. It's embarrassing. So he has got that revolutionary spirit. But I think over the years, as I say, as he's got older, and I think it's, you know, it's that thing, isn't it, that, you know, people say that as you get older, you typically get more conservative. Was it Churchill said something like a man at 30 who's not a liberal has no heart, a man at 40 who's not a conservative has no brain? Along those lines.
Yeah, words to that effect. It's the head heart thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
So Noel has kind of, you know, has he fallen into that as he's got older and richer and you know, less, further and further away, both geographically and philosophically from Burnage?
I think unarguably it has had an effect. And he is very comfortable, very affluent, has children, which I think does change your perspective as well, that suddenly when you're young, don't have kids, perhaps you're more infused by social disorder. I know he's spoken about, for instance, worrying about knife crime with kids. I think that's one reason he's moving out of London. So I think there's that. And then, yeah, undoubtedly, you become more detached from say the lifestyle, the kind of people you'd mix with when you were starting out in music. But I think Noel's also maintained a sense of his roots, though. So I think there's change, but there's also a lot of continuity, and he's kept a lot of the friends he's had before. He talks about Manchester and the attachment they still have to Man City, and I don't think there's never been that sense that I left my past behind when I went to London and made it, and the sort of the world's my oyster now. They're still very rooted band, and Noel might express skepticism at protests and radicalism, which I think still shows in some ways that he's got an eye for a good tabloid headline. I think some of it is he enjoys winding up to liberals and radicals. I think there's that slight sort of, you could see it as sort of middle-aged contrarianism, that I'll say this and wind the kids of today up. But he's not an example of someone who has, so metaphorically speaking, crossed the floor to the conservative side. And there are, you know, musicians who you could probably cite who would unashamedly say, I vote conservative now, you know, because I've got a head. But I think Noel would still see, non-conservative parties, probably not just as the sort of the idealistic choice, but as the sensible one too.
Mm. I mean, I'm just looking at, you know, so some of his quotes from a couple of years ago, sort of post, where are we here? This is interview with City Life from 2019. So he's talking to someone from Manchester. There was a lot of stuff about Brexit. There's only fucking one thing worse than a fool who voted for Brexit. That's the rise of the cunts trying to get the vote overturned. You take part in a democratic fucking process. If you don't like the outcome, go to North Korea. I sat the day of Brexit and thought, I can't be asked going to the polling station. Who the fuck would want to leave Europe? It's a nonsensical fucking idea. And you wake up the next day and think, fucking hell, shit. But the thing that is taking place after that is frankly a disgrace. It's a disgrace when you see people trying to get that vote overturned, because that's fascism straight up, pure and simple. Flying in the face of democracy, no matter what, because you don't like what fucking happened. And then when he was talking about political beliefs, and he said, people's political beliefs are their own. If that's what he believes in, that's what he believes in. I believe in something else. We're all entitled to our own opinions. I think we live in a society now where everybody who has an opinion, someone will tell them to their face, you're fucking wrong. But who are you or anybody to say your opinions and anything are wrong? You know what I mean? We're living in strange times, aren't we? Where people's beliefs are so opposing. It used to be people who were right-wing and were violent, protesting violently. Now you see people who are left-wing protesting and lobbing milkshakes. Where did the milkshake come from? It's fucking funny as fuck, over each other. So it's like, oh, there was that milkshake thing for a while, wasn't it? But yeah, it's that interesting thing. I hate to say he's just sort of looking at headlines. You know, he feels like a reactionary kind of person that reads the headline, whether it be on the Sun's website or on the Daily Mail or something like that, and then he come up with his kind of half-baked opinion on it, and which is tempting. And as I say, when you're in a sort of a left-wing echo chamber, it's sort of, you go, how dare you? But you know, there is a lot of sense in what he's saying there, I think.
Yeah, well, for me, what stands out there is the line on Brexit, where he was clearly someone who was skeptical about Brexit, clearly thought it was an odd project for the country to embark on when they're more mundane things to be addressing. But like a lot of Labour voters in the North, clearly felt very uneasy about the idea of a second referendum, or about the idea of MPs trying to overrule, revoke Article 50, halt Britain's withdrawal. And that's not surprising because, you know, referendums are an example of direct democracy. It's very rare. It's power in the hands of ordinary people. And again, Oasis have always had that sense of community and the masses. And so it's not really a surprise that someone like Noel feels uneasy with the idea of 650 MPs telling the 17 million people who voted leave, we're actually not sure that the UK is going to leave the EU now.
We live in these strange times now, aren't we, where people's beliefs are so opposing, which is fine, which is good in a way, do you know what I mean? If people believe in so, but the fact that it's now become so, you know, you see, it used to be people who were right wing that were violent, protesting violently. Now you see people who are left wing violently protesting and lobbing milkshakes on. Where did the milkshake thing come from? Throwing milkshakes at each other. It's like, I was talking about this and now it's going, what? I thought, what? So you're now seeing people from the left are no better than the people from the right in that respect. It's quite sad, really. And all over something that was, frank, you know, a democratic vote took place and it went one way and the other people don't like it. And I said to most people, there's only one thing worse than a fool who voted for Brexit. That's the rise of trying to get the vote overturned. You know, it's like you take part in a democratic process. If you don't like the outcome, go to North Korea. If I had my eye sat the day of Brexit and thought, oh, come on, I was going to the voting station, who the would vote to leave Europe? It's just a bit of this nonsensical idea. And you wake up the next day and just think, you know. But the thing that's taken place after that is frankly a disgrace.
Let me just, I'll just go on to some Jeremy Corbyn stuff. So he said, I hate the Labour Party. I have fucking got no time for them anymore. Fucking student debater, fucking captain fishy, craggy, old fucking donkey, fuck off. And then he called Diane Abbott the face of fucking buffoonery. They talk pipe-smoking communist nonsense. I think the role of any politician in the world is to be forward-thinking and modern and contemporary, looking forward. And make no mistake, in this country, we need someone, and it ain't him, and it's never been anyone from the Conservative Party. The two extremes are the Labour Party don't respect people who are aspirational, and the Conservative Party don't protect the vulnerable. But somewhere in the middle is where New Labour danced, and they kind of had it fucking right. And then 9/11 happened, and here we are. I think that pretty much sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Noel is an example of what sort of became known as a centrist dad. So it is those who look back to the New Labour period with nostalgia. And it's interesting. There are some other quotes where he was very disobliging about Blair. And I think I'm sure you can find stuff where he said the Iraq War was a mistake and terrible and so on. But you can see how faced with Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour left on one side, and then the sort of Tory right and Brexiteers on the other, someone like him thought, well, actually, I think they had it right in the 90s. So there is a strong degree of continuity with Noel's politics, but like everyone's, they've been shaped by the context in which they, and all of these questions are, of course, thrown at him by interviewers. I think that's the other thing we should, is that you have some sympathy when he's continually asked his opinion on all of these things, because he's always been someone who's clearly of the view that bands should reference political social events in their lyrics, but they're not political parties, and that you're not there to sort of issue a manifesto. And so he naturally shoots from the hip.
Yeah. I think the big thing that we just need to talk about, maybe to round this off, is the most recent thing, which caused a lot of controversy. And that was, like, number one, the fact that Noel speaks to the Sun, you know, a lot of artists won't, understandably so, and a lot of Northern, especially obviously Liverpool-based people, generally don't. But he always has, as I say, he has a relationship with Gordon Smart. He appears to have a very good relationship with the Sun, in that they appear to be after Liam all the time, and then they will always give Noel this incredibly great coverage. And so he doesn't appear to have any issue with dealing with the Sun or talking to the Sun whatsoever, which I know angers a lot of people, but I think, you know, I think he probably quite enjoys that it pisses people off. Like, he's always been a contrarian. He's always enjoyed that kind of, that deliberately sort of winding people up. And so, as much as, you know, when it sort of came out that, you know, with his comments on Prince Harry, calling him a fucking woke snowflake, and it was on the front page of The Sun, well, you know, there was a lot of people on my timeline sort of saying, oh, this is outrageous. You know, Noel is, he's sold out. Noel's always spoken to The Sun, you know. And also, that wasn't an interview to go on the front page. That was an interview about the album. But obviously, he will always spout whatever crap he wants to. And what else these days is going to get Noel Gallagher on the front page of The Sun to promote an album? Even if he slagged off Liam, you know, that would typically used to be his go-to kind of thing, to talk about a reunion or to have a go at Liam. That's not going to get him on the front page now. Slagging off Jeremy Corbyn's not going to get him on the front page. But slagging off Prince Harry and Meghan, and it works. And so I don't think you know, I had people sort of saying, oh, he'll be gutted that they've taken that interview and put it on the front page. I imagine he was laughing his ass off, and I imagine his PR people were popping champagne corks. And what happened to the album? It went to number one.
Yeah, I think your analysis is entirely correct. And I think for Noel, he probably sees speaking to The Sun as an extension of Oasis's general approach, which is, let's try and get the biggest stage possible. And the Sun is still, by most measures, the country's biggest selling paper. So you can see why, for all of the justified skepticism and hostility that some bands have, you can see why it appeals to him, that platform. And he still hasn't, he's very quotable. And this is why I think journalists have a degree of loyalty to him. Because if you're an interviewer, you want someone who gives you not just a good headline, but multiple headlines. So you're spoiled for choice. And I think interviewers generally are with Noel Gallagher. And on the Prince Harry stuff, I think he probably saw it. He quite enjoyed taking a pot shot at a royal as well. I think there's a class element there, I think. And I don't think he's someone who gets particularly agonized about woke culture and identity politics. I think that's more of an expression of a sort of degree of contempt for Harry as a royal and as an individual, rather than some wider sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, he does, you know, the interviews he does on Matt Morgan's podcast, they do often end up basically in whingy bloke territory, like whingy kind of middle-aged bloke territory, you know, which often does get into, you know, these days you can't say anything, you know, these days cancel culture, you know, which is just lazy, really, you know, in reality. It's, you know, it's just the lazy and obvious thing to say. You know, you can't say anything. Well, you can, and you do all the time. So obviously, you know, it's like, what is it, Andrew Neil and these people setting up that new news channel. It's like, oh, because no one's listened to us. Well, except for the fact you've got an editorial and a newspaper, and you've got, all of these various radio stations and things that will all carry your stuff. But yeah, I mean, he said, Prince William, I feel that fucking lad's pain. He's got a fucking younger brother shooting his fucking mouth off with shit that is just so unnecessary. I'd like to think I was always the William. And he said, Prince Harry's come across like a typical fucking woke snowflake. Fucking asshole. Just don't be fucking dissing your family, because there's no need for it. This is what happens when you get involved with Americans. Simple as that. So it's like, it's funny, you know, he's funny. He's a comedian, you know. This is the sort of, whether or not he really means all that stuff, I don't know. Whether it was just a ploy and he knows he's going to get on the front page, I think it's, you know, it is, there is definitely, he has got that kind of, that moany, not happy about this current sort of, you know, snowflake or woke or whatever, very gender politics and things that, that maybe he's not as in tune with, not being of that generation. But yeah, I just think it's hard because, you know, number one, I mean, firstly, I'd like to point out, I'd never clicked the Sun once to read that. You know, I read like the NME's version of it, because I would always avoid giving them the clicks wherever I can. But I understand it. I understand what, where he's, I understand where, you know, and I like to hear it. I don't want to hear the 1975 telling me that, you know, that, you know, don't eat meat or fly a plane. You know, I actually want people to say controversial stuff. And as long as it sort of walks the line and it's not going into that, like comedian Andrew Lawrence, the other, you know, yesterday or whatever, then great. You know, say something interesting and different and exciting, you know?
A healthy argument to start the day. What better way? We chew the fat of life. We move to tears. Lend me your ears. You spend all your time waiting in static shopping lines, and all your troublesome debates are solved in glossy magazines. And too much small talk leads to a small mind.
Yeah, I think Noel's always had that sense that rock stars these days, you mentioned Coldplay earlier, are too boring. That no one wants to risk offending anyone. And obviously, so Noel almost glorified in offending people in the 90s. And it's interesting that you wonder how some of his quotes would be received now in the age of social media. You can imagine... some of them, I suppose the one about Damon Albarn, Alex James comes to mind, would have caused even more of a storm than they did in the tabloids. Because essentially now the rows that used to be played out through the tabloids day by day now get played out on social media minute by minute. Mm. But I think he has always had a sense of where the line is. And I think he's always been wary of becoming defined by any particular political view or standpoint, because politics divides people. That's the definition of it. You're left or right, you're leave or remain. And I think Noel's been someone for whom music is always going to be bigger than politics. Mm-hmm. And ultimately you want as many people to listen to your music as possible. And that will mean people of all political persuasions coming to your gigs. And so I don't think he's ever got to the point where some bands do, where they're almost saying, if you vote for this party or if you believe in this, basically don't come to my gig, so you're not going to feel welcome. Mm-hmm. And there's the sense that the fans are almost the equivalent of a political party meeting or a protest. They're all of one mind. Whereas I think with Noel, I think he's probably relaxed about anyone of any persuasion coming to his gigs, with the exception of the obvious example of say the far right or something.
No, it's interesting. Well, let's see what the good people of Twitter have said about this. At SeanEd75, I've seen him state a few times he could never vote Tory. Having said that, some of his views do seem to lean that way. He's certainly no socialist, but then he's never claimed to be, unlike a lot of hypocritical musicians. Adam Morasati says, I think there's a lot to talk about regarding the context of the first album politically, even if all the lyrics aren't direct. It was definitely shaped by the politics of the time, particularly the impact in the North. Sean75 also said they were Thatcher's children, the desire to escape their drab hometown, the naked ambition and unashamed desire for wealth, success and everything that went with it. Obviously raised Labour, but think Noel feels politically homeless, while I doubt Liam has ever voted. It's very well put, I think.
Mm. Yes, I mean, that is a great irony is that they exemplify in their attitude on Definitely Maybe that contempt towards the Conservatives because of Thatcherism and because of what it did to the North. But they exemplify the sort of the get rich quick economics of Thatcherism and the market. And so you can see why a politician like Blair appealed to Noel, because Blair was essentially a politician who said, well, you can have it both ways. You can want a fairer society and support social justice, but you can also want to paraphrase Peter Manson, be intensely relaxed about people getting filthy rich.
Yeah. I was about to say that. I was trying to place that Mandelson quote. Yeah, absolutely. That's what it's all about. Gerhard Erasmus says, there will be lots of opinion dressed as facts, sadly. No offence. We know very little of their politics, really. I'd be surprised if either of them voted ever. Well, as we said, politics is more than a cross in a box. And I think we've covered a lot of it. And I think we've done a good job, George. Paul Chandler says, moronic reactionaries detached from the real world, I'd say. Thank you for that. Mark Dudley, we all know Noel's voted Tory since 2010, don't we? That's why he and Liam don't speak anymore. And Nanomaticals, who's at Every Song Sung, says, my thinking is it's a risky topic. Well, it's definitely that, and we'll wait and see what people's reactions are to the topic. But I think it's, as I say, I think without them being the Manics or without them being Billy Bragg, I think it is a really fascinating area that, you know, that there's so much more. I think we've covered a lot of it, but I think it's, you know, and we'll have to see what happens as the next albums come out, and as you know, and as things change in British politics and world politics, how Noel and Liam will react to that over the next few years.
Yeah, and I think probably I'm like most listeners, dream sort of semi-regularly of a reunion, but I'm also of the view that it will never happen.
Oh, fair enough. Well, and George, where can you see, obviously the left in a funny place, Keir Starmer having come in, taken over from Corbyn, and we thought, okay, well, you know, there was this huge swathe of people that came to the Labour Party, the momentum kind of movement under Corbyn, and it really engaged young people in a way that the Labour Party hadn't for a generation. But then obviously Corbyn was never going to win the election, so they got rid of him. And then the hope, I suppose, was that Starmer would come in and kind of still keep those young people on board, but also kind of get those swinging middle people that Labour really need to win the election. But where, you know, having a few months down the line, where do you see him at the moment and the left?
I think Labour's in a difficult position. And I think one thing that both Corbynites and sort of Blairites would agree on is that people don't know what Labour stands for at the moment. It hasn't got a clear enough definition. And I think that has to change. And I think Starmer and his team know that. They're also in a difficult position because this has been an unusual political moment in terms of Starmer's been walking this tightrope between trying to be constructively critical and making it clear where the government's made mistakes during the crisis, but not wanting to be seen as the opposition trying to undermine the government at a time of national emergency. I think that's difficult for any leader to balance. But in terms of where the wider left is at, there isn't an obvious left alternative to Starmer at the moment, in the sense that the Socialist Campaign Group, which was so the faction that Corbyn identified with, at the moment they don't have the numbers needed to put up a candidate. The person who is a rival to Starmer in terms of Labour members' affections and in terms of his increased profile is Andy Burnham, who is an interesting political figure in terms of someone who has captured the public's imagination, a hugely popular mayor of Greater Manchester, one with significantly increased majority. And that's someone who would be interesting to sort of see what Noel and Liam make of him, because he's someone who had been written off. He'd stood for the Labour leadership twice and lost, had been seen as someone who flip-flopped, who started as a new Labour cabinet minister, then after Labour's defeat in 2015, very much pitched himself to Blairite voters as someone who would break with some of the policies Ed Miliband had promoted. But then when Corbyn sparked this wave of enthusiasm, shifted to the left again. But I think he's been reborn as a politician by getting out of Westminster and through his obvious commitment to Manchester and through the personal loyalty and appeal that mayors carry. Yeah. So, and I mean, one view on how Labour recovers is that it will be through politicians on a local level, like Andy Burnham, who show what Labour politicians can do when they've got power. Because I think that's the other problem that Starmer's had, is that in opposition, all you can do is say things. There's not much you can do. And I think at the moment, the Conservatives are in the position where, after years of austerity, which had a terrible effect, obviously, on significant parts of the country, including probably areas that the Gallaghers know very well. There's a sense that they've opened the coffers, and through things like the furlough scheme and so on. And so I think as those policies get unwound, though, as they are being to some extent already, the government will be in a trickier position again, because you'll see unemployment rise. They're talking about cutting universal credit by £20 a week. That would cost family over £1,000 a year. So, some of the social discontent that we talked about earlier, which you saw it in the 80s, and then in times during the Cameron era as well, with protests and riots, it's not unthinkable that you could see that return as we enter an era that's less dominated by COVID.
Mm. Going back to the Andy Burnham thing, I was wondering, I was thinking Andy Burnham, because Noel did talk about Andy Burnham recently when he was talking to the Metro, I think, and he said Andy Burnham, he's a fucking good lad. He said, I'm still a Labour supporter. I wasn't a Jeremy Corbyn supporter. Fuck that idiot. Andy's one of the very few politicians who stood up to the government, and for that, I take my hat off to him. I've met him a couple of times, and bar the fact that he's a Scouser, of course, he's a fucking good lad, and he seems to be a good mayor. I wouldn't be too upset if he was the Prime Minister. He seems to be a man of the people, and he speaks well, and if he was leader of the Labour Party, I'd vote for him tomorrow. It's ironic that it's a Scouser who stood up for Manchester so well. Good on him. All you want from any politician is talk fucking sense, and sadly, most of them you see on TV talk out of their arseholes. The way he was standing up to the government during lockdown, he's not been a maverick. He's talking sense. More power to him. So there you go. That's something I think, doesn't it?
I hadn't actually seen that interview, but I think you do see the continuity there. So are we going to see a Burnham Noel meeting at Downing Street one day?
Yeah, exactly. The next election, when Prime Minister Burnham invites Noel down the red carpet. Sounds good to me. Wonderful, George. All right. Well, look, thank you so much for your time this evening, mate. It's been a fascinating discussion. I wait to see what the comments are going to be. And where can the people find you online and tell us about the New Statesman again?
Yes. So you can subscribe. You should subscribe to the New Statesman in both print form and to our website as well. You can read lots of great columnists and we have a weekly album review, long interviews with musicians, book reviews, film, TV. So it's sort of culture as well as politics. And then you can find me on Twitter at George Eaton.
Wonderful. All right, George. Well, thank you so much for your time, mate.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Don't believe celebrities, the money sucking MPs, the device in your hands, imitation beauty. Comes when the water
down by the river.
So thank you very much to George. I hope you guys enjoyed that. It was really, I really enjoyed that discussion. It's something I've thought about for a long time. And yeah, I'd be interested to hear you guys, what you think about that, what your feedback is. Do feel free to get in touch through the usual routes. And make sure you're following George at George Eaton. And if you want to get hold of the New Statesman in paper or in digital form, you know how to do it. All right, so we'll leave it there, shall we? Thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast. And most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is, and it's greatly appreciated. There was a Patreon exclusive episode that went up this week. It was a quiz, a 1 second Oasis quiz between Richard Bowes, the reigning world heavyweight champion of Oasis knowledge, and plucky contender Sean Wright. So if you want to hear how that went, then do head over to patreon.com/oasispod. But if you want to have a go at the quiz yourself and give it a try with the 1 second clips, then the YouTube video is now up with that. So I'll link it in the description below. Do please follow on the social medias at Oasis Podcast on Twitter and Facebook, and Oasis Pod on Instagram. Feel free to email me, oasispod@gmail.com. And if you can write a review over on Apple Podcasts, that's always greatly appreciated. So until next time, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.